Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Ion Travel with Peter Greenberg ad-free and right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, your travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to the podcast that's done from a different location around the world every single week. One day Canada, the next day Thailand, then New York, London. You just never know. This week we come to you from our nation's capital at the St. Regis Hotel in Washington, D.C., taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. If you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. You can also follow me on Twitter. My handle is @PeterSGreenberg or Facebook, facebook.com/PeterGreenberg. Where we're coming to you from now is basically half a block from the White House. What a great historic hotel. Every single U.S. president since Calvin Coolidge has been in this hotel. I said two blocks from the White House, short walk to the Washington Monument, and a great, great location. Lots of stuff to talk about in the news this week, and part of it is just basically the weather, what's happening in North Carolina, severe storms again. And weird weather, you know. It may be winter, but it's 80 degrees out in Southern California, and New York is 50 degrees one day and 0 degrees the next day. It's crazy, and that wreaks havoc, of course, with the transportation system. Bottom line is, if you need to get anywhere, first flight out, everybody. Anything after the first flight out of LaGuardia, you better bring a copy of War and Peace because you'll be reading it. It's as simple as that. Bottom line is, as the presidential campaign heats up. And all the primary states, it's interesting to see how the weather is affecting the campaign and how the different candidates get there. We know Donald Trump flies his own 757, but what about the other candidates? Are they on a Greyhound bus? You might be surprised as the money starts to run out for some of these campaigns. It's very interesting to see how they coordinate the logistics of a presidential run and how they pay for it and how they block rooms. It's just really fascinating stuff. If you're on the advance team of a candidate, you are like a super travel agent who gets no respect. It is simple as that. And, you can watch the news and see these guys show up in these different cities, but how did they get there? How did their team get there? How did their advance team get there? How did their volunteers get there? How many peanut butter and jelly sandwiches can they make? I mean, it's pretty crazy. As you know, President's going to be heading down to Cuba very soon. And speaking of Calvin Coolidge, we just did, he's the first U.S. president to go since Calvin Coolidge. Think about that. Think about all the things that will be happening very soon in Cuba. May 1st, the first U.S. cruise ship setting sail for Havana for the first time in over 60 years. That's pretty wild, or nearly 60 years. And then, of course, the U.S. negotiating and concluding the negotiations with the Cubans for the resumption of scheduled airline service between the United States and Cuba. And, you know, we'll talk about this for the next couple of weeks because I don't want to get everybody too excited about this because at the end of the day, even though they've negotiated this, there's an infrastructure problem and there's a capacity problem that people aren't even realizing because in a way we've been negatively propagandized by omission when it comes to Cuba. We think that just because we haven't gone, that nobody else has been going. Just the opposite. Everybody else has been going. There are only 60,000 available hotel rooms in Cuba, and they're already occupied by everybody else in the world who's been going there for over 60 years. So for us to show up now, there's a capacity problem. Where are we going to stay? The irony is that Airbnb now has, are you ready for this, over 4,500 listings in Cuba. People renting out their homes. Capitalism lives in Cuba, ladies and gentlemen. Now, the first U.S. cruise ship going in May 1st. That doesn't mean the U.S. is going to be sending in scheduled airline service May 1st because those slots have to be negotiated. And they have to be negotiated at the U.S. Department of Transportation level with all the major airlines that want to go. Now, you may remember in the old days, going back to the 1950s, Eastern Airlines flew there, American Airlines flew there, Pan Am flew there. Well, we know Pan Am's not around. Eastern's not around. Some of those routes were taken over with either mergers or consolidations by the airlines that are still flying today, like American. But the U.S. Department of Transportation came to the conclusion that those rights weren't dormant. Those rights were dead. So everything's back on the table. Everything's open for negotiation. And what the Cubans have done, which I think is fascinating, is they basically said, okay, we're going to allow 110 daily flights to Cuba. But of those 110 daily flights, only 20 can go to Havana. That means the other 90 get spread out over 9 other airports in Cuba that you've never heard of. The reason for that is not because Cuba suddenly wants to distribute the goodies. It's because Havana is saturated. So there are only going to be 20 scheduled flights a day to Havana, divided among American, United, Delta, Spirit, Frontier, Allegiant. It's going to be an interesting horse race here to see the jockeying that happens. And the most interesting part of that is that the airlines involved who want to go to Cuba are not going out and buying new planes to service the route. They're reallocating their assets, which means if you're the Minister of Tourism of St. Martin or Grenada or Barbados or, for that matter, San Juan or the Dominican Republic, you got a problem because you're about to lose air service. They're going to take some of those planes away from you and fly them where they can make more money to a place that everybody suddenly wants to go to. Now, let's talk about that more money aspect. Airlines are all about, it's a yield game now. It's not about a market share game. It's how much can they get per seat? And if everybody wants to be first on their block to go to Cuba, it's the law of supply and demand. They're going to be very expensive flights. But wait, it's about to get worse. I said there's an infrastructure problem. It goes way beyond the hotels. How about cigar production, sugar production, rum production? Cuba can't literally ramp that up. So imagine the first guys going in will be cruise ships. Imagine 5,000 passengers rolling off a Royal Caribbean ship in Havana looking for the last 3 remaining Cuban cigars. I mean, it'll be the worst case of the price is right because the price will be wrong. And just be prepared for that. So my advice is don't wait for scheduled airline service. Try to be a part of one of the 12 different organized, recognized, approvable groups of people-to-people, educational, research, humanitarian, medical, that are allowed to go to Cuba right now on charter flights. Get in there now. Enjoy it now. You know those historical designations of AD or BC? You've read them at school. You studied them. Well, I have another one for you. I came up with it. It's BKFC. Go before Kentucky Fried Chicken gets there, because you know something? They're coming. Every other major corporation is coming. They removed the blocks on the credit card, so now you can use and swipe an American-based credit card at terminals throughout the country as they start installing them at lightning speed. Okay? You know what that means? Ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
You know, whenever I come into town, I want to ask a local about stuff that may not be in the brochure, may not be in the guidebooks, and my next guests know a little bit about that. They're the purveyors of Foodie and the Beast, and it's David and Nikki Nellis. When did you start this, guys?
Well, I'll make a long story short. Nikki's been a foodie since she came out of the womb, and I, until I met her, thought a good meal was sitting down from the stuff I was grazing at the refrigerator. But we are...
My kind of guy.
Yeah. We were.
Well, you guys can go out to dinner together.
Let's do that.
No, we'll go out to the refrigerator. Okay.
We were on a cruise with friends of ours from WTOP, which is the leading radio station here in the marketplace. And I am kind of a meatball and all that. So we were having a food fight. We were having an argument about some aspect of dining. And they said, gee, that would make a good radio show.
Well, except for the fact, I think what you're missing is that I'd already been covering the food and wine scene in D.C. for years previously. And I was currently on the WTOP radio station doing trend reports and things of that nature for the food and wine scene. So while we were having those food discussions, they thought, wow, we have another channel. We should do some lifestyle programming there. What can you guys do?
All right, so now let me be devil's advocate. Everybody claims they're a foodie. Everybody.
I don't.
Not him.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy with a burger and a beer and a, you know.
You and I are going out to dinner.
That's, I hope so. You're buying, by the way.
Of course. If it's a burger and a beer, of course I'm going to buy. No, but when you see what's going on now, at least the culture is saying, we want a hot new restaurant, we want a hot new chef. Is there any sort of a chef anymore who's not a celebrity chef?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think what's going on in the D.C. dining scene, I mean, listen, you have your Mike Isabellas and your Jose Andres, and they deserve their accolades. But there are lots of men and women in the D.C. dining scene who are cooking and who are cooking really terrific food. They're not necessarily looking to get their names in lights, and they really believe in hospitality, which I think what people have to remember is that the restaurant industry is a part of the hospitality industry.
Absolutely. Sometimes the restaurant industry forgets that,
everybody,
too.
Everybody, listen, it's really easy to forget, and when your place is packed and you've got all these people running around, you know, it's always hard to be hospitable.
All right, I'm going to give you my pet peeve, okay? I do it all the time, by the way. I finally figured it out. The one thing I hate about restaurants is what I call the terrible twos. I don't want to sit at a two-top, so I always make a reservation for three. Then they got to put me at a table for four.
So do I.
I do it. I'm sorry. And you want to charge me four for it? I'll pay it. But the last thing I want to do at the end of the day, when I want to have a nice intimate dinner with somebody, male or female, it doesn't matter. I don't want to have to rub elbows with people I don't know and not have enough space at the table to talk.
I always lie and say the other two called in sick, but...
Well, that's Elijah. That's Elijah.
Elijah's at the door. Well, and I appreciate where you're coming from, but I am going to give you the other side of the coin, which is that restaurants... Everything is by square foot. So they have to pay?
I said I'd pay more for it.
Okay, well, then you have to let them know that. Because, I mean, I appreciate where a restaurant comes from. I mean, everything in that restaurant costs money.
Yes, but
everything.
Here's the deal. I'll give you my next pet peeve.
Go ahead, let's hear it.
And then you can tell me the other side if you don't agree. Ready?
Okay, absolutely.
What is a restaurant reservation if not an implied contract? So it's a promise. So if I'm supposed to be there at 8 o'clock and I get there at 8 o'clock and the table's not ready in the hospitality industry, if I was running the restaurant, I'd say, Nikki, go to the bar, drinks on me.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't make you go to the bar and then tell you how to settle your tab there before you can go to the table. This is all about the bar.
But some restaurants do that.
Very few do.
Okay, I agree with you like 50%. Here's the thing about some restaurants. Some restaurants
Let me know when she agrees with me more than 50%.
I've never heard that for me.
So. I know. Yeah.
Okay, so some restaurants can afford to do that.
No, and it's not what it costs. It's what it's worth.
I hear what you're saying. But the thing is that when... You make a reservation at 8 o'clock at night, and they've already taken people in for, let's say, 6 o'clock. Those people should have left by 7:30.
Right,
but if they don't leave, you can't kick them out.
No, you electrify the chairs and shock the crap out.
In Italy, they say, c'è sole fuori, there's sun outside, go see it.
But in all honesty, if I'm running the restaurant, I don't make money if you come once. I make money if you come back and tell
all
your friends. So if I tell you, how much would you be loving me if I said, Nikki, drinks are on me, And whenever you're ready to go to the table, we got it.
No, absolutely.
And you tell your friends.
Of course. I totally agree with you. Not everybody has the ability to do it, but those that do, do better.
But I'll give you the converse side.
Okay.
Let's say I have a reservation at 8 o'clock and I don't show up. Or let's say I have a reservation at 8 o'clock and I'm there 30 minutes late.
Mm-hmm.
You've already taken my credit card when I made the reservation, and there's a $50 penalty, and I'd be willing to pay that too.
Well, I actually applaud that idea because I really can't stand restaurants that don't take reservations. I think nothing says hospitality less than making people wait online.
All right, I'll go one step beyond.
Okay.
What's worse, the one you hate, the restaurant that doesn't take reservations,
mm-hmm.
or the restaurant that insists on them and doesn't honor them?
Well, I have to be honest, I don't mind waiting a couple minutes. So it doesn't bother, I've never had to wait that long.
I
it do. Does not bother me.
You are, you're not
like, I'm like, come on already. But
I don't mind going to the bar, having a drink, talking with friends. I don't mind
food.
It.
Nick, I have to tell you something.
I know.
Dave and I are getting married.
Have a good time. You can be number four. Have at it.
That's right.
Be number four.
If you can handle it, Peter, I don't know. But here's the one thing I want to get back to when you talk about the restaurant scene here, and that is it's way more than the food, because we have a local craft brewing scene and craft distilleries and all of that that's happening.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel, cruising and playing the radio, with no particular place to go.
We've been talking with David and Nikki Nellis, and I think they're still married. Yes? Okay, good.
So far.
Nowhere else to go.
They're the host of Foodie and the Beast right here in local radio here in Washington. Nikki's also doing The List, which I want to talk about in a second.
Mm-hmm.
But let me go back and ask a question before we even get to craft beer. Everybody that I know in Washington, and maybe I'm just not seeing this through a different lens or proper lens, I happen to guess that Washington has probably some of the most underutilized kitchens and private homes, because everybody's going out. I don't see people cooking at home.
That's good for business. But we're capitalists,
No,
I don't know if that's entirely true. I mean, listen, I'm a total and complete advocate for the restaurant industry. What's going on here is insane. The amount of restaurants that are opening up every day, every week. It's not just happening locally, it's happening nationally. I mean, people are really investing in quality restaurants.
Right.
But I think people are also really entertaining. I mean, there's a reason why the Food Network does so well. People are watching people make food and going out and buying good quality food and then cooking it up in their home. So maybe people...
When was the last time you cooked at home?
Oh, last night.
I cook, even when I go out, and we go out an awful lot, I cook for my family almost every night.
We have five kids, two still at home.
Still
and
home.
We have dinner together, I mean, probably six nights a week.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
I stand corrected.
And the other night we lock him in the closet.
You'll get used to it when you're with me.
Listen, I'm already getting used to it. I haven't been right once.
I want your listeners to know my life is hell.
When was the last time you were right, David?
Let's see, June of 97, I think.
Probably.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
I think I carved that dump somewhere.
All right, when you talk about, Nikki, talk about all these restaurants opening up,
mm-hmm.
talk about The List.
Okay, so I started The List almost 14 years ago just because it was information that I wanted. It's before blogs and things like this kind of radio show, podcasts, all that kind of stuff. It was information I wanted about the food and wine scene in D.C. as far as all these events happening. At the time, you just couldn't find it. So now it's a publication. It goes out to 35,000 people, and it's uber-focused on D.C. We write about every food and wine event happening in D.C., so you know about it, everything from festivals, charity events, you know, wine dinners, etc. And then restaurants opening up.
A lot of them.
And openings, and that's parlayed into everything else I do.
I'll give you my story. I was a real creature of habit here in D.C. for years. I go back 30 years now or longer. I only hung out at two restaurants,
mm-hmm.
both of which are gone now, Germain's
mm-hmm.
and Joe and Moe's.
No, Moe just passed away.
I know he did. I know. Moe is such a great guy.
What a mensch.
He was Ralph Cramden.
He was a great guy.
He was Ralph Cramden. I'll tell you a story if I have time. He called me one day. He said, I have a way to make a lot of money. I said, what are you talking about? He says, I'm going to become a contestant on a quiz show. I said, what are you out of your mind? He said, Mo, what are you doing? He says, I got a jacket and a tie, because he never wore that. He said, I'm going to wear a jacket and a tie. And I'm coming out to L.A. and I'm going to get on a show called Sail of the Century. I said, so where are you? He says, oh, I'm staying at your house. So Mo comes out, camps at my house.
Oh, he's making money there. Just paying for the room.
Right, right. I'm not making this up. He comes out, and he goes for the audition. And he comes back, he goes, I got. So he flies back to see DC. Now he's waiting for his choice, his call. He gets the call. So I figure, okay, he's going to stay at my house. Uh-uh. No.
Four seasons.
I said, wait. I said, Mo, where are you? He's in a triplex suite at Universal Studios.
No.
I said, Mo, you have no money. What are you standing there for? You don't understand. If you want to be a winner, you got to think like a winner.
How did this guy have no money? He had the most successful restaurant.
This is how he had no money. He gets on the show. He wouldn't tell me. They taped the show. So I wasn't there for the taping. And it was the fastest appearance by a contestant ever. He was aced and thrown off the show in about 8 minutes. And he was on the red eye back to D.C.
My name is Mo. Get out of here.
Right. But here's the question. You know, they spin the wheel. And you have to, if you get the right wheel, you get to answer the question. Mm-hmm. Then you go for the big money.
Right.
They asked them, ready for this? Mo, who is the Viking explorer who supposedly discovered America before Christopher Columbus? And Mo says, I got it. Who is that? He goes, Nordstrom's.
Oh, my God.
So that's one strike. The second one, right? They asked him, okay, who knows the cleanest form of energy? Boom. Mo gets it. Yes, I have it. What's the answer, Mo? He goes, coal.
Oh, my God.
He was on the red eye. That was it.
Oh, my God, that's so funny.
But, I mean, we miss Mo a lot. And that was a great restaurant.
I'm going to, this is not one-upsmanship. I'm one of only seven people living who has a certificate acknowledging that I had breakfast, lunch, and dinner in one day at Joe and Mo's. My office was
you
right
know
upstairs.
What? That's right.
That's right. I'll sell it to you.
It was on Connecticut Avenue.
Yeah. I was at Rhode Island, Connecticut.
I know. Amazing. What a great guy.
He was a good man.
I know. But now, of course, Nikki, Jermaine's is gone. Joan Mo's is gone. But it's been replaced by, what, about 100 restaurants?
More.
Way more. I mean, there's, it depends on what you're looking for, but, you know, the ethnic cuisine in the city has skyrocketed, and it's not just like little holes in the wall places. You know, there's really, you can do everything from really fine dining to, you know, upscale casual to, you know, it's just not a steakhouse town anymore. I know everybody wants to do steaks in D.C., but, I mean, some of the, there's really amazing eating in the city. Tom Sietsema just did, you know, he named the 10 best dining cities in the country. In the Washington Post, and D.C. was in there, and it deserves that place.
And it wouldn't have been in there 5 years ago.
We should name some names, because you're talking one of the finest restaurants in town. Every year, perennial winner is Rasika, which is an Indian restaurant.
I go there for that spinach.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, the palachat.
Oh, my God. The palachat and the tandoori salmon. Oh, unbelievable.
Delicious.
I mean, Indian food is one of the best. You know, that's you got to scratch your head, but it's unbelievable.
There's no scratching your head. The food is delicious.
Well, you don't usually say the best restaurant in the city is Indian food.
But they come close. I like Acadiana.
There's nothing wrong with Acadiana.
They have the most amazing oysters. The grilled oysters with the Parmesan. Oh, my God.
But let me tell you about some of the new restaurants in town. Do we have time? Because I can tell you about Convivial, which is a fabulous new restaurant in the Shaw District with Cedric Maupier. And you got Kinship by Eric Siebold, who used to be at Citizen.
Before we run out of time, it's Foodie and the Beast on the radio.
Yep.
But Sundays the list is on. Give me the website for the list.
Thelistareyouonit.com.
You know what? I'm not on it.
Well, you better get on it.
Okay. So, David Nikki Nellis, still married after the second segment.
And happily, too.
It's only 20 years.
Right. I'm the man of her dreams.
In your dreams.
No, in hers, too.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hello? This is your captain speaking. There is absolutely no cause for alarm.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway, looking for adventure, and whatever comes our way,
This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
Now, joining me now, in the interest of full disclosure, she works for, indirectly, one of my former employers, the Washington Post. My former employer many years ago was Newsweek, which was then owned by the Washington Post. And she's an amazing columnist for them. Roxanne, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Roxanne Roberts, how long have you worked there?
28 years.
So they haven't found out?
They have not, no.
This is good.
No, underaged, what can I say?
And you've seen the changes. I mean, you know, I am sick and tired of people telling me that newspapers are a dying breed. And I'm glad to see that at least somebody with deep enough pockets to prove me right is running your show.
Well, it never hurts. For those that don't know, Jeff Bezos, the man who invented Amazon and now one of the richest men in the country, owns us, which is great for us because he has given us, as he terms it, runway to experiment as we move into the digital age.
And in fact, if I read the stories correctly, he hasn't cut, he's increased.
He's investing deeply because I believe what he'd like to do with the newspaper business is create the kind of following that e-retail has. You know, before that, people were afraid to buy. And now everybody is moving to reading online on their phones, on devices. And I think he wants to be the leader in that industry.
Now, you recently did a column about something that people aren't really thinking about yet, but they should. And that is, we are in an election year. Some people might call it a clown car, but it's still an election year. And I call it a clown car. It's rather entertaining until you have to stop and take a deep breath and realize how serious it is. And by the way, I know exactly what the day is because it's also my birthday. So every 4 years, someone gets inaugurated on January 20th.
That's your birthday,
it
huh?
It is.
Okay.
And this town gets transformed if it's not 8 feet of snow. And there have been inaugurations where there were. But people need to plan ahead if they're coming. And who actually comes to this?
Well, it gets divided between two groups. I mean, the one thing that Washington knows that regardless of who gets elected, there are going to be people here for the inaugural. And
it's sort of like the Final Four of the Super Bowl.
Exactly. In that
it doesn't
sense.
Matter who's playing, the people are going to show up.
Well, half of the people who show up will come regardless. They come because they have some sort of corporate presence or one of the party presidents, but they know they're going to be here. And then there's a whole bunch of people who on the day after Election Day says, damn it, honey, let's go. And that they're the ones who scramble at the last minute. So that's the last ones who are looking for the remaining rooms. But like the Super Bowl, you get your better deals if you sort of make your mark early on.
Or I got my secret tip. Always ought to go to the Super Bowl for free. You want to hear it?
Yeah.
Okay, here's it. Never fails. Just like the inauguration, you know where the game's going to be. You just don't know who's playing, right?
Right.
All right, so let's say the Super Bowl next year is going to be in New Orleans. I'm just throwing that out. February, I pick up the phone, and I call the concierge, let's say, at the Ritz-Carlton in New Orleans. And I remember, I only want two tickets, and I want one room. But I say to the concierge, hey, I'm going to come into the Super Bowl. I want three rooms, and I want six tickets. Here's my credit card. Get them. No problem. Now, I don't do anything.
Of course, you're Peter Greenberg, so that does change the equation a little bit.
No. When I tell you how this works, it works for everybody. So now I don't do anything, right? About 3 weeks before the game, as the excitement's building, that same concierge calls me and goes, do you really need all three rooms? And do you really need all six tickets? Of course you don't. So you turn him around, make him the broker. He doubles or triples the face value. You give him back the rooms, and now your trip, your tickets, and your room are paid for from the sale of the other four tickets.
Are we sure this is legal?
It's totally legal.
Okay, then. Now, for the inaugural here, it gets pretty expensive, though, because all the big hotels have packages that go for vast amounts. I'm always shocked how much they go for.
We've done stories on CBS about some of these packages. They're ludicrous. They're ludicrous. I mean, they throw in a diamond shopping spree. It's the limo. It's the fashion. It's everybody. And that's just to get a room.
Well, it's to get the room. And then sometimes they come with extras. But I'll make this case, a free market case. If you've never been to an inaugural and somebody that you care about is becoming president, it's one of those bucket list things that you should try to do. And you don't necessarily have to be at a fancy hotel, but it is thrilling to see democracy in action.
Well, we're talking to Roxanne Roberts in the Washington Post, but I would make this case, and I think you'd agree with me. Whatever hotel is selling the package, they're not going to guarantee you entrance into one of the inaugural balls.
That's completely true, and I try to warn people. I am in the businesses of making sure that I manage people's expectations. And people think an inaugural ball is like a state dinner and it's all fancy and exclusive. And it's really like a giant cocktail party with bad cheese in an auditorium. And I want people to come and I want them to go home so happy. So I try to tell them, don't buy expensive clothes to come unless you already have them, and wear flat shoes and dress warm because you might have to stand outside for hours and hours and hours. I want people to have a thrilling time if they come. I don't want them to be disappointed.
And every 4 years, there are inaugural scams.
Oh, more so.
They'll take out ads saying, watch the inauguration, blah, blah. Yeah, you'll be watching it on your television in your hotel room.
I was so disappointed in 2009, where a lot of people hoping to capitalize on the excitement about Barack Obama had what they called inaugural balls. People spent a lot of money. They bought tickets, and then they didn't materialize, or they turned out to be something like that. So the only people that can actually invite you to an inauguration or an official ball is the Presidential Inaugural Committee. And you have to be pretty plugged in with either
a large checkbook.
Or a longtime party faithful.
With a large checkbook.
I am less cynical than you are, but okay. That won't hurt.
There you go.
It won't hurt. But
now, if you don't want to go out and buy one of those expensive hotel packages, who says you have to stay right where we are right now? You can stay in Virginia.
Yes.
And just take the train.
Yes. The nice thing about D.C. is that we have a pretty extensive metro system, and it's pretty cheap and it's pretty efficient. So I would encourage people to come, but be wide, you know, wide-eyed, but not in awe, you know, sort of trust but verify when you come, and plan to soak up the history. You were talking about the monuments. I mean, honestly, and when you walk down the mall and you see the Lincoln Memorial, you know, you really should get some goosebumps when you do that. You should think about what it took for our country to get to this place, and that's part of the excitement of being here.
Now, I know we're about 9 months away, but give us your inside scoop on, you have no tickets to the inauguration.
Right.
You have no tickets to the inaugural ball. You're staying in a hotel in McLean, Virginia.
Okay. Where I live, which is a lovely city. Thank you very much.
I just guessed that, didn't I?
You did.
I know. But you want to come in and watch something.
Right.
Where would you stand? Assuming there's not 8 feet of snow.
Well, I would watch on television because, particularly the inaugural ceremony, because you're not likely to be close, which means you won't be able to see anything and you'll be standing outside.
When the president
outside.
Gets out of the car and starts walking, where do you want to be?
Well, you know, you can line up on the parade route if you're dressed warm enough and you're willing to take your chances, get there early in the morning. The parade route's not a bad place to do it.
Although something tells me you're going to be in McLean watching on TV.
If I'm lucky, and I won't have to be outside in the cold.
You see, spoken like a true reporter. When I was at Newsweek, everybody says, oh, you're going to go cover the Rose Bowl? And I said, hopefully not.
If you are sitting next to a small child or someone who is acting like a small child, please do us all a favor and put on your mask first.
We have so many great restaurants in Washington, D.C., and it's probably one of three capitals in America that I would call power dining, L.A., New York, and Washington, D.C., for different reasons, of course. And my next guest knows a lot about that because she's got a couple of them. It's Maria Trabocchi, who's from a number of restaurants, including Folie Mare.
Folie Mare, yes, in Georgetown.
Yes. And now you are Spanish.
Yes.
Your husband's Italian.
Very.
You get along?
For now. Today, yes.
But I mean, you take these restaurants very seriously because the restaurant customers do.
Yes.
What's special about your restaurant? What exactly are you serving there that you're not going to find anywhere else in D.C.?
Well, the one in Georgetown specifically is a seafood restaurant, and I think...
Which is what I love, by the way.
I love seafood, yeah. Too, and I think it's one of those... fish is a thing that can characterize a chef better than anything else, because anyone can cook a steak.
But if you mess up on the fish, boy, you're in trouble.
1 second off the fish and it's completely dry or whatever. So we have a great selection of fresh fish every day. We have about 65 suppliers from all over the world just to change our menu daily.
You know, what's funny is I thought I knew what I was doing in the kitchen. I don't. But the lesson that I learned is if you're going to cook a piece of fish, don't take your eye off it. because it's going to cook very quickly most of the time.
Oh, yeah, yeah, totally. I don't even dare touch fish ever, you know.
You let your husband do that.
That's why I married him. Clearly, yes.
What's the one dish that you would call your signature dish?
I think lobster ravioli is the one that everybody keeps going for. And actually, we also have it at Fiola downtown, but it's lobster ravioli. People keep coming back every single time.
And right now, the market price for lobster is not bad.
It's a little bit better, but it fluctuates like everything else.
Right, but I mean, a year ago, man, you could have bought as many lobsters as you wanted.
Yeah, true.
Crazy. Hmm. So like the oil prices.
Yeah, it's...
There's no explanation for it. I can't understand it. All of a sudden, the market just completely dropped.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, when we talk about power dining, you have to deal with people jockeying for tables, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, power dining in D.C. Is crucial. Like, as you mentioned before, like it could be New York, Chicago, you know, things like that. In D.C. is the political scene, clearly. Plus, big power companies that come here to do political deals as well. So when I look at the book every day, every morning for all restaurants, and I choose who's sitting where based on who they are.
And who's talking to who. And can't be seen with
and
who.
Exactly, who cannot be next to each other, which is probably the most important part.
Which means you better read the newspapers every day.
I read the newspapers every day. I'm constantly on social media finding out what's the latest deal, what's happening, who is here, who's not. And then I also had to be very aware of who's the new member of Congress or who's substituting who, who's running for Congress or for Senate.
Although, if you do your homework right, you could actually help broker world peace.
I could do that, but I don't know if I have enough time for a 1 hour lunch.
It all depends on what you're serving.
That's true too.
With enough wine, they'll be there all afternoon.
With enough wine, you know, anything can be done. Everything is negotiable that way.
Now, I always ask this question. I've got to ask it to you. What's the one item at Field of Honor that you put on the menu thinking everybody's going to love it and nobody did?
Percebes.
Which is?
Which is barnacles.
What?
Which has a specialty from Galicia in Spain.
Well, you and I just talked about Galicia.
And it is a delicacy, and those are caught by hand and the rocks and the ocean, so they're extremely expensive, and they're delicious. And nobody, you look at them, and they're really, really ugly. Nobody knows how to eat them, and every time we buy them, it's a very expensive item.
Wow.
And nobody ever buys them.
Get the
171
contact departure.
Contact departure,
idle base, go 423,
adios.
AMAX 403, contact departure, adios.
Over departure, gentlemen, 171, awesome job.
You know, one of the most annoying questions a five-year-old asks, because they never ask it once, they ask it 5,000 times, is why? But you know what? It's the question we should always ask. It's what questions I always ask. And so what better person to ask that question now than me, to my guest, Martha Humler, who's going to answer it because she's the author of a book called...
Why? Because you get paid to smile and serve.
About the service industry.
Exactly.
Now, we all know in the hospitality business, it's a service industry. It's sort of a lost art, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, people don't look at it that much in this country as a profession the way they do in Europe. In the more mature countries, it's always about, I like being a waiter. It's what I do, and I do it very well. Here, you know, you ask if somebody's a waiter, the next question is, okay, what acting school do you go to?
Right.
Right? So there's a whole different deal.
But I also think it doesn't just apply in hospitality. I have stories in the book, retail, your insurance broker. Do they serve you well?
Don't get me started.
Exactly.
I'll give you a great service story. I was in Michigan in a place called Birmingham. And I get a phone call from the network saying, change of plans. We need you to be on the air tomorrow morning in Orlando at 6 a.m. Well, there's only one flight out from Detroit to Orlando. I didn't have anything to wear. I had 4 hours before the flight left. So I said to the front desk, is there a Nordstrom's around here? They said, as a matter of fact, there's one about a mile away. So I said to a cab driver, take me there, and then we'll go to the airport. So I ran in, and I said to the guy, I just need two shirts, a tie, a jacket, a pair of pants. And they didn't have anything in my size. And he said, well, we can order it from another store. And I said, I don't think you understand. I got to get this and go to the airport. He goes, what time is your flight? I never met this guy before. I said, it's at 420. He said, what airline? Told him. He said, I'll meet you at the counter. This guy didn't know me from anything. But here's the funny part of the story. I get to the airport. He's waiting there with my clothes. And before I had a chance to thank him, the next day I got a thank you letter from him. From him. Now remember.
That's good.
Right?
Yes.
And this is a guy who lived to serve.
Well, and my background's retail also, and I think hospitality and retail already have established themselves over the years that they needed to do a little bit better job.
So what would you say right now is the one task that needs to be done?
Look at their hiring practices and see if they're hiring the right people that really like serving customers. You know, it's amazing to me, the people that are just taking the job. They might as well go. They should, if they don't like dealing with customers, they can be an artist. That's a solo job.
And a lonely job.
Exactly.
But the thing is, it's the questions that they ask in the job interview, too.
Exactly. And then training. I think there's not enough companies, again, across different industries. I have 27 different industries represented. Personal stories that happened to me. No names, of course.
See, that's where we're different. I would name everybody.
Well, maybe the second book.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yes. But the first one, I wanted to be a little bit more discreet. And all personal stories to me, nothing I relied on that had happened to someone else. In a course of time of 7 to 8 months, the book was written.
Now, what was the biggest lesson you learned in writing this book?
That unfortunately, even though I was in the business for 22 years, and we always taught hire the right people, train them correctly, it's still not happening for some reason. There's a big complacency. And I think the younger generation, too, is just saying, this is as good as it gets. This is all we've known.
And they're accepting that.
Exactly. And we need to speak up more. We need to complain. We need to look at online surveys and complete them. And smart companies will hire people within their organization to be monitoring those and reacting and fixing things.
Can I add one more thing?
Sure.
We need to have a conversation. People need to look at, like, I'm looking at you right now. You're looking at me. You need to have a face-to-face conversation with people, not text them, not just go online, and learn from them.
Yeah, exactly.
I know, because they'll tell you. Your customers will tell you anything you wanted to know, good, bad, or ugly, if you just talk to them.
Right. I heard you on one of your previous shows talking about the airlines. Of course, they are a whole chapter in the book as well. And as you said in that, nobody wants to get their hands into the bad business and see how they can take care of it better. And that's it. Even the people at the top aren't taking these complaints as seriously as they should to improve themselves.
When was the last time the chairman of American, United, or Delta flew in seat 35E.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
If I were running an airline, I would make it my point once a week to fly the line, not announced, pick any plane at random, 35E.
Well, the last three chapters, again, all my experience, my humble opinion, the three things you need to do, and that's how you hire people and what kind of people you hire, training. And the third thing is, even if you do those two things well, if you don't have the right leadership at the top, it's going to fail.
Now, by the way, in the interest of full disclosure, who's your husband?
Irve Humler.
What does he do for a living?
He works in the hotel business.
Name the hotel.
Mm-hmm. Ritz-Carlton.
What does he do there? Don't look at him.
He's the president, COO.
So you know what we have to say right now?
No.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
And certainly.
Right. No.
But we have to mean it.
Exactly.
That's the whole point.
Yeah. That's what makes him a good leader.
Yeah, because he means it.
Yep, exactly. Right.
We have clearance, Clarence.
Roger, roger. What's our vector, Victor?
Now I radio clearance, over.
That's Clarence, over.
Over.
Roger.
Huh?
I always like to go and ask the locals every time I go someplace, and my next guest I think now qualifies as a local. He goes back to... the last century, actually.
Pretty close,
it's
yes.
Correct.
Yes.
Come on.
Yes, it is. Yes,
it is correct.
Yes.
But his name, of course, is Frank Ruta. He's the executive chef over at the Grill Room at the Capella. But before we get to your hotel and your restaurant, you had a rather interesting upbringing here.
Yes, I did. I was brought to Washington in 1980 by the Carter administration. I was hired by the executive chef then there, Henry Holler, and Mrs. Carter. And was hired at the White House.
In the last year of the Carter presidency.
In their last year of the Carter presidency, that's right.
All right, so let's put some rumors away.
Okay.
You didn't serve grits.
No, not that I recall. Right, we did not serve grits.
What was the craziest dish the president ever wanted at 2 in the morning?
Well, oddly enough, they're very disciplined. They didn't have snacks at midnight snacks or anything at 2 in the morning. They had breakfast, lunch, dinner, and that was pretty much it.
Wow.
We left. We had leftovers. It was a family setting with the Carters. You know, Amy was there. She was 12 or 13. Chip Carter was probably just a little older than I was. I was 22.
And wait a minute. There was Billy Carter.
Billy Carter would drop in, and Miss Lillian would drop in every now and then. So it was very family.
But if you had Billy Carter, you had Billy Beer.
There was Billy Beer, and there was a lot of Billy, what do we call it, drama or a little bit of activity that every now and then got, I think, Miss Lillian involved. And even at that age, he was scolded. I heard that a couple of times.
What were your biggest challenges?
At the White House?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think we had that many challenges. Everything was very regimented. Everything was very focused. Wasn't that big of a crew. I think the biggest challenge was that it wasn't that big of a crew. It was very different than what goes on now with Chef Comerford. There were four of us. There was one in pastry and three on savory side. And we had to ramp up for big functions. And we had to
State dinners,
state luncheons. We had cocktail receptions. We had hors d'oeuvre parties. We had, it could be a working luncheon. It could be just about anything that was going on in the White House that we had to get ready for. We had a couple of people that helped us part-time, but for the most part, it was just the four of us manning the stoves.
So Jimmy Carter just had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich?
I don't recall peanut butter and jelly, but pimento cheese. We had pimento cheese sandwiches quite often. It was fried chicken. I mean, there were some staples, just like any other family had favorites. They would interject into the menu every now and then. But
now you remember George H.W. Bush hated broccoli.
He did hate broccoli, and I tell you a story. One time, he was out of the White House on a trip somewhere, and Mrs. Bush was eating alone, and I cooked broccoli because she liked broccoli. And she said, you know, I think George would like that. Can you make that whenever he comes back? So there was this whole big thing about the broccoli. It just was about that time. But we cooked the broccoli and served it. And he may have liked it. He didn't want to admit it. But he came. I remember recall him coming into the kitchen and saying, that was nice. And he looked me straight in the eye and he said, don't ever do that again. So
my kind of guy.
Yeah. So after my knees stopped shaking, I said, yes, sir. And that was the end of that. But I think it was just a little bit of fun that Barbara may have been, Mrs. Bush may have been having with President Bush.
Now, after the White House, you went where?
After the White House, I had the ambition of opening my own restaurant, like any young cook does. And I went to work for, at the time, who was one of the top chefs in the city here, Yannick Cam. He had a restaurant called Le Pavillon in downtown Washington.
I remember.
And I worked with Yannick on and off for about 5 years at two or three of his restaurants.
And then
I set off and I opened my restaurant in October of 2000, also in D.C. on Connecticut Avenue, and that stayed there for about 14 years. We were there about 14 years.
And then you got smart.
I guess that's what it was, right? We stopped there, and I was hired about a few months after that. Mr. Bradley hired me at the Capella Hotel in Georgetown, the grill room, to man that stove there.
All right, now I got to ask this question because you do it of every chef.
Okay.
What's the one thing you put on the menu there that you thought was going to be the best-selling item ever, and it tanked? And what was the one item you thought, no one's going to order this, and everybody did?
You know, I'm pretty cautious, and I have to say I'm pretty conservative to a certain extent. When we put something on the menu, we have to feel good about it, that we put it out there. I don't think we've ever done anything where we're that surprised, where we say, I don't understand why that's not selling. Usually if it doesn't sell, we'll just change the verbiage a bit on the menu.
You try to sneak it around.
Yeah, I try and sneak it around a little bit so that they're still getting what they bargained for.
So we're not talking brains or sweetbreads. We're talking...
Right. I just think it could be a different fish. It could be a different type of offal, maybe calf's liver or beef or veal tongue. Those are, you know, I think every chef loves and embraces those things.
I'm not going for the veal tongue, okay? We got that? All right, very quickly, give me one or two places that you like to hang out.
I always like to hang out at places where... they're fairly small places. I like Eto on 14th Street. DC has such a great ethnic scene that I like eating at, you know, Korean restaurants or Japanese restaurants in the city. Sushi Taro is another one in DC, and there are a few on the outskirts of Izakaya Seki's, another great Japanese place.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Catch us each week as we broadcast from a new location somewhere around the world.
If you like Ion Travel with Peter Greenberg, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings early and ad-free starting May 1st with a 48 Hours Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts.